things went on very well with Daniel in his new world, except that a boy with whom he was at once inclined to strike up a close friendship talked to him a great deal about his home and parents, and seemed to expect a like expansiveness in return. Daniel immediately shrank into reserve, and this experience remained a check on his naturally strong bent toward the formation of intimate friendship. Everyone, his tutor included, set him down as a reserved boy, though he was so good-humored and unassuming, as well as quick both at study and sport, that nobody called his reserve disagreeable. Certainly his face had a great deal to do with that favorable interpretation, but in this instance the beauty of the closed lips told no falsehood. A surprise that came to him before his first vacation strengthened the silent consciousness of a grief within, which might be compared in some ways with Byron's susceptibility about his deformed foot. Sir Hugo wrote word that he was married to Miss Raymond, a sweet lady whom Daniel must remember having seen. The event would make no difference about his spending the vacation at the Abbey. He would find Lady Mallinger a new friend whom he would be sure to love, and much more to the usual effect when a man, having done something agreeable to himself, is disposed to congratulate others on his own good fortune and the deducible satisfactoriness of events in general. Let Sir Hugo be partly excused until the grounds of his action can be more fully known. The mistakes in his behavior to Deronda were due to that dullness toward what may be going on in other minds, especially the minds of children, which is among the commonest deficiencies even in good-natured men like him, when life has been generally easy to themselves, and their energies have been quietly spent in feeling gratified. No one was better aware than he that Daniel was generally suspected to be his own son, but he was pleased with that suspicion, and his imagination had never once been troubled with the way in which the boy himself might be affected, either then or in the future, by the enigmatic aspect of his circumstances. He was as fond of him as could be, and meant the best by him, and, considering the lightness with which the preparation of young lives seemed to lie on respectable consciences, Sir Hugo Mallinger can hardly be held open to exceptional reproach. He had been a bachelor till he was 45, had always been regarded as a fascinating man of elegant tastes. What could be more natural, even according to the index of language, than that he should have a beautiful boy like the little Deronda to take care of? The mother might even, perhaps, be in the great world, met within Sir Hugo's residence abroad. The only person to feel any objection was the boy himself, who could not have been consulted, and the boy's objections had never been dreamed of by anybody but himself. By the time Deronda was ready to go to Cambridge, Lady Mallinger had already three daughters, charming babies, all three, but whose sex was announced as a melancholy alternative, the offspring desired being a son. If Sir Hugo had no son, the succession must go to his nephew, Mallinger Grandcourt. Daniel no longer held a wavering opinion about his own birth. His fuller knowledge had tended to convince him that Sir Hugo was his father, and he conceived that the baronet, since he never approached a communication on the subject, wished him to have a tacit understanding of the fact, and to accept in silence what would be generally considered more than the due love and nurture. Sir Hugo's marriage might certainly have been felt as a new ground of resentment by some youths in Deronda's position, and the timid Lady Mallinger with her fast-coming little ones might have been images to scowl at, as likely to divert much that was disposable in the feelings and possessions of the baronet from one who felt his own claim to be prior. But hatred of innocent human obstacles was a form of moral stupidity not in Deronda's grain. Even the indignation which had long mingled itself with his affection for Sir Hugo took the quality of pain rather than of temper, and as his mind ripened to the idea of tolerance toward error, he habitually liked the idea with his own silent grievances. The sense of an entailed disadvantage, the deformed foot doubtfully hidden by the shoe, makes a restlessly active spiritual yeast, and easily turns a self-centered, unloving nature into an Ishmaelite. But in the rarer sort, who presently see their own frustrated claim as one among a myriad, the inexorable sorrows takes the form of fellowship and makes the imagination tender. Deronda's early weakened susceptibility, charged at first with ready indignation and resistant pride, had raised in him a premature reflection on certain questions of life. It had given a bias to his conscience, a sympathy with certain ills, and a tension of resolve in certain directions, who marked him off from other youths much more than any talents he possessed. One day, near the end of the long vacation, when he had been making a tour in the Rhineland with his Eton tutor, and was come for a farewell stay at the Abbey before going to Cambridge, he said to Sir Hugo, "What do you intend me to be, sir?" They were in the library, and it was the fresh morning. Sir Hugo had called him in to read a letter from a Cambridge don who was to be interested in him. And since the baronet wore an air at once businesslike and leisurely, the moment seemed propitious for entering on a grave subject which had never yet been thoroughly discussed. "Whatever your inclination leads you to, my boy. I thought it right to give you the option of the army, but you shut the door on that, and I was glad. I don't expect you to choose just yet. By and by, when you have looked about you a little more and tried your mettle among older men. The university has a good wide opening into the forum. There are prizes to be won, and a bit of good fortune often gives the turn to a man's taste. From what I see and hear, I should think you can take up anything you like. You are in the deeper water with your classics than I ever got into, and if you are rather sick of that swimming, Cambridge is the place where you can go into mathematics with a will, and disport yourself on the dry sand as much as you like. I floundered along like a carp." "I suppose money will make some difference, sir," said Daniel, blushing. "I shall have to keep myself by and by." "Not exactly. I recommend you not to be extravagant." "Yes, yes, I know you are not inclined to that, but you need not take up anything against the grain. You will have a bachelor's income, enough for you to look about with. Perhaps I had better tell you that you may consider yourself secure of 700 a year. You might make yourself a barrister, be a writer, take up politics. I confess that is what would please me best. I should like to have you at my elbow and pulling with me." Deronda looked embarrassed. He felt that he ought to make some sign of gratitude, but other feelings clogged his tongue. A moment was passing by in which a question about his birth was throbbing within him, and yet it seemed more impossible than ever that the question should find vent, more impossible than ever that he could hear certain things from Sir Hugo's lips. The liberal way in which he was dealt with was the more striking because the baronet had of late cared particularly for money, and for making the utmost of his life interest in the estate by way of providing for his daughters. And as all this flashed through Daniel's mind, it was momentarily within his imagination that the provision for him might come in some way from his mother. But such vaporous conjecture passed away as quickly as it came. Sir Hugo appeared not to notice anything peculiar in Daniel's manner, and presently went on with his usual chatty liveliness. "I am glad you have done some good reading outside your classics, and have got a grip on French and German. The truth is, unless a man can get the prestige and income of a don and write donnish books, it's hardly worth while for him to make a Greek and Latin machine of himself, and be able to spin you out pages of the Greek dramatists at any verse you'll give him as a cue. That's all very fine, but in practical life nobody does give you the cue for pages of Greek. In fact, it's a nicety of conversation which I would have you attend to. Much quotation of any sort, even in English, is bad. It tends to choke ordinary remark. One couldn't carry on life comfortably without a little blindness to the fact that everything had been said better than we can put it ourselves. But talking of dons, I have seen dons make a capital figure in society, and occasionally he can shoot you down a cartload of learning in the right place, which will tell in politics. Such men are wanted, and if you have any turn for being a don, I say nothing against it." "I think there's not much chance of that. Quickset and Puller are both stronger than I am. I hope you will not be much disappointed if I don't come out with high honors." "No, no, I should like you to do yourself credit, but for God's sake don't come out as a superior expensive kind of idiot like young Brecon, who got a double first and has been learning to knit braces ever since. What I wish you to get is a passport in life. I don't go against our university system. We want a little disinterested culture to make head against cotton and capital, especially in the house. My Greek has all evaporated, but if I had to construe a verse on a sudden, I should get an apoplectic fit. But it formed my taste. I dare say my English is the better for it." On this point Daniel kept a respectful silence. The enthusiastic belief in Sir Hugo's writings as a standard and in the Whigs as the chosen race among politicians had gradually vanished along with the seraphic boy's face. He had not been the hardest of workers at Eton. Although some kinds of study and reading came as easily as boating to him, he was not of the material that usually makes the first-rate Eton scholar. There had sprung in him a meditative yearning after wide knowledge which is likely always to abate ardor in the fight for prize acquirement in narrow tracks. Happily he was modest and took any second-rateness in himself simply as a fact, not as a marvel necessarily to be accounted for by a superiority. Still, Mr. Fraser's high opinion of the lad had not been altogether belied by the youth. Daniel had the stamp of rarity in a subdued fervor of sympathy, an activity of imagination on behalf of others which did not show itself effusively, but was continually seen in acts of considerateness that struck his companions as moral eccentricity. "Deronda would have been first rate if he had had more ambition," was a frequent remark about him. But how could a fellow push his way properly when he objected to swap for his own advantage, knocked under by choice when he was within an inch of victory, and unlike the great Clive, would rather be the calf than the butcher? It was a mistake, however, to suppose that Deronda had not his share of ambition. We know he had suffered keenly from the belief that there was a tinge of dishonor in his lot, but there are some cases, and he was one of them, in which the sense of injury breeds not the will to inflict injuries and climb over them as a ladder, but a hatred of all injury. He had his flashes of fierceness and could hit out upon occasion, but the occasions were not always what might have been expected. For in what related to himself, his resentful impulses had been early checked by a mastering affectionateness. Love has a habit of saying, "Never mind," to angry self, who, sitting down for the nonce in the lower place, by and by gets used to it. So it was that as Deronda approached manhood, his feeling for Sir Hugo, while it was getting more and more mixed with criticism, was gaining in that sort of allowance which reconciles criticism with tenderness. The dear old beautiful home and everything within it, Lady Mallinger and her little ones included, were consecrated for the youth as they had been for the boy, only with a certain difference of light on the objects. The altarpiece was no longer miraculously perfect, painted under infallible guidance, but the human hand discerned in the work was appealing to a reverent tenderness safer from the gusts of discovery. Certainly Deronda's ambition, even in his springtime, lay exceptionally aloof from conspicuous vulgar triumph and from other ugly forms of boyish energy. Perhaps he was early impassioned by ideas and burned his fire on those heights. One may spend a good deal of energy in disliking and resisting what others pursue, and a boy who is fond of somebody else's pencil case may not be more energetic than another who is fond of giving his own pencil case away. Still, it was not Deronda's disposition to escape from ugly scenes. He was more inclined to sit through them and take care of the fellow least able to take care of himself. It had helped to make him popular that he was sometimes a little compromised by this apparent comradeship. For a meditative interest in learning how human miseries are wrought, as precocious in him as another sort of genius in the poet who writes a Queen Mab at 19, was so infused with kindliness that it easily passed for comradeship. Enough. In many of our neighbors' lives there is much not only of error and lapse, but of a certain exquisite goodness which can never be written or even spoken, only divined by each of us, according to the inward instruction of our own privacy. The impression he made at Cambridge corresponded to his position at Eton. Everyone interested in him agreed that he might have taken a high place if his motives had been of a more pushing sort, and if he had not, instead of regarding studies as instruments of success, hampered himself with the notion that they were to feed motive and opinion, a notion which set him criticizing methods and arguing against his freight and harness when he should have been using all his might to pull. In the beginning, his work at the university had a new zest for him. Indifferent to the continuation of Eton classical drill, he applied himself vigorously to mathematics, for which he had shown an early aptitude under Mr. Fraser, and he had the delight of feeling his strength in a comparatively fresh exercise of thought. That delight and the favorable opinion of his tutor determined him to try for a mathematical scholarship in the Easter of his second year. He wished to gratify Sir Hugo by some achievement, and the study of the higher mathematics, having the growing fascination inherent in all thinking which demands intensity, was making him a more exclusive worker than he had been before. But here came the old check which had been growing with his growth. He found the inward bent toward comprehension and thoroughness diverging more and more from the track marked out by the standards of examination. He felt a heightening discontent with the wearing futility and enfeebling strain of a demand for excessive retention and dexterity without any insight into the principles which form the vital connections of knowledge. Deronda's undergraduateship occurred 15 years ago, when the perfection of our university methods was not yet indisputable. In hours when his dissatisfaction was strong upon him, he reproached himself for having been attracted by the conventional advantage of belonging to an English university, and was tempted toward the project of asking Sir Hugo to let him quit Cambridge and pursue a more independent line of study abroad. The germs of this inclination had been already stirring in his boyish love of universal history, which made him want to be at home in foreign countries and follow in imagination the traveling students of the Middle Ages. He longed now to have the sort of apprenticeship to life which would not shape him too definitely and rob him of the choice that might come from a free growth. One sees that Deronda's demerits were likely to be on the side of reflective hesitation, and this tendency was encouraged by his position. There was no need for him to get an immediate income, or to fit himself in haste for a profession, and his sensibility to the half-known facts of his parentage made him an excuse for lingering longer than others in a state of social neutrality. Other men, he inwardly said, had a more definite place and duties, but the project which flattered his inclination might not have gone beyond the stage of ineffective brooding if certain circumstances had not quickened it into action. The circumstances arose out of an enthusiastic friendship which extended into his afterlife. On the same year with himself, and occupying small rooms close to his, was a youth who had come as an exhibitioner from Christ's Hospital, and had eccentricities enough for a Charles Lamb. Only to look at his pinched features and blonde hair hanging over his collar reminded one of pale quaint heads by early German painters. And when this faint coloring was lit up by a joke, there came such sudden creases about the mouth and eyes which might have been molded by the soul of an aged humorist. His father, an engraver of some distinction, had been dead 11 years, and his mother had 3 girls to educate and maintain on a meager annuity. Hans Meyrick, he had been daringly christened after Holbein, felt himself the pillar, or rather the knotted and twisted trunk round which these feeble climbing plants must cling. There was no want of ability or of honest well-meaning affection to make the prop trustworthy. The ease and quickness with which he studied might serve him to win prizes at Cambridge, as he had done among the bluecoats, in spite of irregularities. The only danger was that the incalculable tendencies in him might be fatally timed, and that his good intentions might be frustrated by some act which was not due to habit, but to capricious, scattered impulses. He could not be said to have any one bad habit, yet at longer or shorter intervals he had fits of impish recklessness, and did things that would have made the worst habits. Hans, in his right mind, however, was a lovable creature, and in Deronda he had happened to find a friend who was likely to stand by him with the more constancy, from compassion for these brief aberrations that might bring a long repentance. Hans, indeed, shared Deronda's rooms nearly as much as he used his own. To Deronda he poured himself out on his studies, his affairs, his hopes, the poverty of his home, and his love for the creatures there, the itching of his fingers to draw, and his determination to fight it away for the sake of getting some sort of a plum that he might divide with his mother and the girls. He wanted no confidence in return, but seemed to take Deronda as an Olympian who needed nothing, an egotism in friendship which is common enough with mercurial, expansive natures. Deronda was content, and gave Meyrick all the interest he claimed, getting at last a brotherly anxiety about him, looking after him in his erratic moments, and contriving by adroitly delicate devices not only to make up for his friend's lack of pence, but to save him from threatening chances. Such friendship easily becomes tender. The one spreads strong sheltering wings that delight in spreading, the other gets the warm protection which is also a delight. Merrick was going in for a classical scholarship, and his success, in various ways momentous, was the more probable from the steadying influence of Deronda's friendship. But an imprudence of Merrick's, committed at the beginning of the autumn term, threatened to disappoint his hopes. With his usual alternation between unnecessary expense and self-privation, he had given too much money for an old engraving which fascinated him, and to make up for it, had come from London in a third-class carriage with his eyes exposed to a bitter wind and any irritating particles the wind might drive before it. The consequence was a severe inflammation of the eyes, which for some time hung over him the threat of a lasting injury. This crushing trouble called out all Deronda's readiness to devote himself, and he made every other occupation secondary to that of being companion and eyes to Hans, working with him and for him at his classics, that if possible his chance of the classical scholarship might be saved. Hans, to keep the knowledge of his suffering from his mother and sisters, alleged his work as a reason for passing the Christmas at Cambridge, and his friend stayed up with him. Meanwhile, Deronda relaxed his hold on his mathematics, and Hans, reflecting on this, at length said, "Old fellow, while you are hoisting me, you are risking yourself. With your mathematical cram, one may be like Moses or Muhammad or somebody of that sort who had to cram, and forgot in one day what it had taken him 40 to learn." Deronda would not admit that he cared about the risk, and he had really been beguiled into a little indifference by double sympathy. He was very anxious that Hans should not miss the much-needed scholarship, and he felt a revival of interest in the old studies. Still, when Hans, rather late in the day, got able to use his own eyes, Deronda had tenacity enough to try hard and recover his lost ground. He failed, however, but he had the satisfaction of seeing Merrick win. Success as a sort of beginning that urged completion might have reconciled Deronda to his university course. But the emptiness of all things, from politics to pastimes, is never so striking to us as when we fail in them. The loss of the personal triumph had no severity for him, but the sense of having spent his time ineffectively in a mode of working which had been against the grain gave him a distaste for any renewal of the process which turned his imagined project of quitting Cambridge into a serious intention. In speaking of his intention to Merrick, he made it appear that he was glad of the turn events had taken, glad to have the balance dipped decidedly and feel freed from his hesitations, but he observed that he must of course submit to any strong objection on the part of Sir Hugo. Merrick's joy and gratitude were disturbed by much uneasiness. He believed in Deronda's alleged preference, but he felt keenly that in serving him, Daniel had placed himself at a disadvantage in Sir Hugo's opinion, and he said mournfully, "If you had got the scholarship, Sir Hugo would have thought that you asked to leave us with a better grace. You have spoiled your luck for my sake, and I can do nothing to amend it." "Yes, you can. You are a first-rate fellow. I call that a first-rate investment of my luck." "Oh, confound it! You save an ugly mongrel from drowning and expect him to cut a fine figure. The poets have made tragedies enough about signing oneself over to wickedness for the sake of getting something plummy. I shall write a tragedy of a fellow who signed himself over to be good and was uncomfortable ever after." But Hans lost no time in secretly writing the history of the affair to Sir Hugo, making it plain that but for Deronda's generous devotion, he could hardly have failed to win the prize he had been working for. The two friends went up to town together, Merrick to rejoice with his mother and the girls in their little home at Chelsea, Deronda to carry out the less easy task of opening his mind to Sir Hugo. He relied a little on the baronet's general tolerance of eccentricities, but he expected more opposition than he met with. He was received with even warmer kindness than usual. The failure was passed over lightly, and when he detailed his reasons for wanting to quit the university and go to study abroad, Sir Hugo sat for some time in a silence which was rather meditative than surprised. At last he said, looking at Daniel with examination, "So you don't want to be an English gentleman to the backbone after all?"
"I want to be an Englishman, but I want to understand other points of view, and I want to get rid of a merely English attitude in studies."
"I see. You don't want to be turned out in the same mold as every other youngster. And I have nothing to say against your doffing some of our national prejudices. I feel the better myself for having spent a good deal of my time abroad. But for God's sake, keep an English cut, and don't become indifferent to bad tobacco. And, my dear boy, it is good to be unselfish and generous, but don't carry that too far. It will not do to give yourself to be melted down for the benefit of the tallow trade. You must know where to find yourself. However, I shall put no vote on your going. Wait until I can get off committee, and I'll run over with you." So Deronda went according to his will, but not before he had spent some hours with Hans Meyrick and been introduced to the mother and sisters in the Chelsea home. The shy girls watched and registered every look of their brother's friend, declared by Hans to have been the salvation of him, a fellow like nobody else, and in fine, a brick. They so thoroughly accepted Deronda as an ideal that when he was gone, the youngest set to work, under the criticism of the two elder girls, to paint him as Prince Camaralzaman. End of chapter 16. This recording is in the public domain.